Welcome back. You are listening to the 20-Minute VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and we have a very unique guest on the show today with a unique model of venture investing in many respects. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Justin Fischner-Wolfson, founder and managing partner of 137 Ventures, a growth stage venture firm that provides customized liquidity solutions to founders, investors, and early employees of high-growth private technology companies. Their portfolio includes the likes of SpaceX, Wish, Anduril, Flexport, and RigUp, to name a few. Previously, Justin worked on the investment team at Founders Fund, and before that served in the US Department of State under Alan Larson, Undersecretary for Economic, Business and Cultural Affairs. I'd also want to say a huge thank you to Christian at 137 for some fantastic question suggestions today. I really do so appreciate that. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carter makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carter. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carter can help. Check them out at carter.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame, and 20 VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. But it's time to head into the show, so now I'm very excited to welcome Justin Fischner-Wolfson, founder at 137 Ventures.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Justin, it is so good to be doing this. I've heard so many great things from a perver at Summit Peak and then also from David Sachs. So thank you so much for joining me today, Justin.
Happy to be here.
I would love to kick off though with a little bit about you. So talk to me, how did you make your way from starting Stanford at just 15 to joining Founders Fund at 24 to kind of more recently, but still, you know, a while ago, starting 137? So summarize your life, I guess, in a solid 2 to 3 minutes.
I'm just curious where you got the 15-year-olds at Stanford number, because I'm not sure that many people know how old I was when I ended up at Stanford.
I stalked you.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. So to kind of run you through the brief history of my life, you know, I ended up at Stanford at 15. You know, part of the reason I was younger, I skipped second grade. Not sure it's a major accomplishment in life, but it did mean that I was a bit younger than everyone else by the time I got to college. You know, part of what got me to Founders Fund was, you know, my time at Stanford. You know, I was working at the State Department while I was there and helped organize a conference in Jordan. And so that was back in 2001, before September 11th. That was kind of after the dot-com bubble and things had crashed. And so, you know, PayPal was still burning a ton of money. And one of the guys who came to the conference was Ken Howery, who people may realize is, you know, currently our ambassador to Sweden. And so I first met Ken, you know, all the way back then, kept in touch a little bit, you know, ultimately got reconnected to him, you know, in 2006 when he was, you know, at Founders Fund with Peter. And that was sort of before Founders Fund became an institutional fund. And then Peter decided in 2007 that, you know, he was going to kind of turn this into, you know, a real venture business. And it was mostly because it just seemed like a really interesting group of people and it sounded like fun. I didn't have a particular bent on trying to get into venture, but I had a really great experience at Founders Fund. It was one of those times where, you know, no one quite knew what they were doing, but everyone got to, you know, contribute. I ended up, you know, bringing in one of the largest investors who ended up anchoring the first institutional fund. And that, of course, you know, got me a lot of credibility very quickly. You ended up leading the SpaceX investment, co-led the Spotify investment with Sean. You know, ultimately, you know, I left you know, start 137 Ventures. And that was really driven because I had a lot of friends from college who ended up at Facebook. And what happened to them is, if you go back and you think of 2011, 2010, right, Facebook was this massive private company. You know, people had all their net worth locked up in this business and they were looking for liquidity. And it struck me as a market opportunity that no one was really addressing. And so we thought that was a good opportunity to, you know, go build a new. And since then, you know, we've raised four institutional funds, you know, done a few co-investments along the way and, you know, built a firm with, you know, over $1 billion in AUM.
Before we move into kind of liquidity and kind of the mechanics of kind of how you operate with 137, I do have to ask, you mentioned kind of the 3 years at Founders Fund there, such a formative moment in your thinking as well. What lessons did you specifically learn from Peter Thiel? I think that you try to apply it to yourself as an investor today, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think Peter is probably one of the best private markets investors ever. I think that's actually a pretty safe statement. And, you know, having kind of spent my early years there, you know, very much influenced how I view the world and how I view investments. There are a few things that come from this, right? One is, you know, you really care about the people, right? It's true at early stage, it's true at the later stage, and you really want to focus on investing, you know, with great people who really are attacking big opportunities. And I think the second piece is really to focus on businesses that have long-term sustainable advantages. You know, these are things like network effects, marketplace dynamics, things that have, you know, information asymmetries, companies that have economies of scale, right? All of these things make it much more likely that if you invest in that company over a long period of time, they're going to continue to be successful. And I think one of the other pieces that I really think is important is that it's the last double on the investment that matters, right? The first double, it's good, but really when you look at the absolute returns on investing, specifically in venture investing, the last double is what really drives all the returns. And so you need to think about what is the full, you know, TAM for these sorts of opportunities.
Can I ask, what do you mean by the last double?
I just think about it. I mean, if, you know, if you have a company that, you know, might be a $2 billion company and you own 10% of it, right? So you've got a $100 million position. If it doubles again, now you've got a $200 million position. If it doubles again, you've got a $400 million position. And so if you think about that relative to fund sizes, that's how you really drive high multiple returns by understanding where that double is going to stop doubling and start looking a lot more like a linear return.
No, I love that. And I've actually never heard it phrased as the last double, but I totally agree in terms of kind of value creation post IPO and I totally aligned there. So if that's kind of the takeaways from working with Peter, you know, I know you're also a big kind of poker player. How do you think about the lessons you learned from poker that you apply to investing?
You must have gotten the poker from David Sachs, I suspect.
Totally did.
I always like playing with David. I mean, I think poker is a really great way of thinking about life. It's a great way of thinking about investing. One of the major things that happens in poker is people get distracted by winning and they think, well, great, I won. I made a great decision. I was totally right. And oftentimes that's not really the case. And to be successful at poker, you know, over a long period of time is about making, you know, positive expected value decision. Whether or not you ultimately win or lose that hand doesn't matter. The question is, were you right to make the decision that you made at the time with the information that you had, right? And so short-term outcomes really are just volatility, right? Some, you know, 2% happens, right? Like these things happen all the time. I mean, you talk to poker players, they always complain about, you know, when that one card came out or whatever, but like these sorts of things happen. And so you can't get distracted by short-term volatility. And I think the lesson from poker that I think very much applies to investing is to focus on process and not outcomes, right? Outcomes matter over a long period of time, but there's a lot of noise. And the better you can focus on making the process, you know, a good decision-making process over time, you will ultimately be successful.
Okay. So with the emphasis on decision-making processes there, that's music to my ears. I'm fascinated by kind of consensus versus non-consensus and how different partnerships approach decision-making. Given the emphasis that you take from that in terms of kind of process over outcome from poker, how did you design 137's decision-making process?
So we've got a partnership, we've got four investment partners, and it's a conversation. And I think what we've tried to do is make it, especially for large investments, you know, relatively consensus driven, right? And making sure, but more importantly, making sure that there's always at least one person who has sort of their reputation on the line for doing the deal. Because the last thing you want to have happen is, you know, everyone says, oh, sure, that sounds fine. Let's, you know, why not, right? But what you really want is at least one person, you know, willing to put their name on the line saying, I think this is a great idea, right? This is something that we absolutely should be investing in. So I think that's part of it. I think, you know, know, there are lots of important details, you know, as you think about companies. Like, I think the first question you always want to ask is this a great company for us to be investing in? Full stop, right? Like, is it above the bar in terms of like the companies that we want to be involved with, right? And then there's a lot of other important questions, right? Like valuation matters, right? And you don't want to let things like valuation sort of influence your decision on whether or not you want to be in the company, because that will lead you, you know, to invest in companies that may not meet your bar because it's a quote unquote great price or something like that, right? So I think you want to kind of ask these questions in serial. And at any point in time, you know, if you get to the, you know, the wrong answer, you say, well, this is not sort of an opportunity that we want to pursue.
Okay, so jumping on this, I have to ask, you know, you mentioned kind of the centrality of person that you took from Peter, and then kind of thinking about what makes the bar, so to speak, in terms of investment. How do you think about market versus founder? And what I mean by that is, you know, Andy Ratcliffe has said on the show before, great market, mediocre founder, market wins. Great founder, mediocre market, market win. How do you think about that relationship between founder and market and the centrality of market?
So I think that's sort of right, but ignores an important piece, which is that markets can change and great entrepreneurs can change which market they're in. And so that's definitely true, right? At the end of the day, you can't be bigger than your market, but you might be able to expand your market by redefining it, or you may be able to move into adjacent markets. And therefore, the ultimate opportunity is much bigger, right? So like if you think about companies like Gusto, right? So we're invested in Gusto, and you know, you could look at that and you can say, well, that's a payroll and benefits company. Well, when they first started, they were actually only a payroll company. So if you define their market as just payroll, then it's one number. And now it became a payroll and benefits company. So, okay, so that's a slightly different number. And then it turns out that they've now started to roll out financial services products for employees at companies that use Gusto. And the other word that you might use for employees at companies that use Gusto are consumers. And so what they've effectively done is moved into another market where, you know, they're taking the opportunity to, you know, that they have a direct relationship with these employees to offer them other products and services that are potentially valuable. And then once again, the market is now different. So, you know, I think you're 100% correct that the market always wins, but you can continue to grow and expand your market. That may make the company much bigger than people originally might have assumed.
I totally agree with you in terms of great founders creating their own markets and also kind of just the transient kind of nature of markets. I have to ask, you also mentioned kind of pricing there. And sorry, this is totally off schedule, but I'm loving this conversation, so fuck it. But in terms of like pricing, you said pricing matters there, but then also, you know, you don't want to kind of do a good deal because of the price. And so I'm intrigued, how do you think about and assess your own price sensitivity, especially given the proliferation of capital that we have today, meaning prices just off the charts, as we were chatting about before?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting question, because my answer is oftentimes price doesn't matter unless you're off by 5x, in which case then price is the only thing that matters. You know, my sort of examples of this are, you know, there's a handful of, you know, well, think about it in two ways, right? One, if you're wrong about the company, it goes to zero, the price doesn't matter. So it only matters when things go well. And so then the question is, can you invest at prices that ultimately hit your cost of capital, right? Because as venture investors, if we don't put up returns, eventually all of our investors will fire us, right? So it doesn't make any sense to insanely overpay for things. You know, because we're in venture and because the companies that we're investing in are high growth companies, there's a lot of uncertainty. It's very hard to have exact precision as to what a valuation should be. So, you know, whatever, you're off by 20%, heck, maybe you're up by 30%. Like, you can sort of overcome that with a high growth company. On the other hand, if you look at companies that are just overpriced by a factor of 10, then it's very hard to make money over almost any period of time, right? Like, that's just a very hard thing to overcome.
Totally is, especially when you're off by that magnitude. I think, you know, this leads to the discussion on ownership. And, you know, a lot of VCs are very centered around ownership. Often, you know, the more traditional, and we're seeing kind of a relaxing of that with newer firms, but the more traditional, definitely with what was 20, now more 15. Before that, you've said to me and before you've said to other people, in terms of like concentration of capital and like ownership, VCs should care more about their cost of capital and less about their ownership percentage. Why do you think that is, when so much of the industry is predicated on ownership percentage?
I think a lot of this has to do with heuristics that were created, you know, a long time ago, and they were, you know, they make sense, but only when you view them in the context for which they were made. And so like, just as a very simple example, which I think really informed my view on this, you know, look back at the Facebook investment that Peter did, right? So a lot of firms looked at that, and a lot of people just decided that they were unwilling to do it if they couldn't get their 20%, right? And then the question is, where does this magic magical 20% number come from? And what it effectively comes from is people are thinking about potential exit values, fund sizes, and saying, you know, I need to own a certain percentage of a company based on some assumption of exit values to return my fund. So that way, if I have a couple of winners, I can generate fund level returns that are attractive to my investor. And like, that all makes sense. But and then when you round that math, you sort of ended up with something approximating 20%. The reason why it's important to not just use heuristics, but to understand where they came from is, you know, what happened with Facebook is Peter ended up investing $500,000 for like 10% of the company. Well, who cares if you only have 10% of the company when the company ends up being $100 billion IPO, right? Like whether or not you own 10 or 20, well, if your options were, you know, 10 or zero, you pick 10, right? And so focusing strictly on ownership percentage really, I think, blinds people to opportunities that may be much larger and they just can't get over the hump from a process perspective to make those investments.
Totally agree with you in terms of getting over the hump there. It does make me think of something that Brian Singerman said to me one day, and he was like, the enemy of great venture returns is limits on the concentration of capital per company. Would you agree with him? And how do you think about kind of concentration of capital on a per company basis?
So I think we generally speaking agree partially because we have a similar viewpoint on investing. We actually think that the concentration of capital is a risk for the manager, right? At the end of the day, the way to make the best returns is to invest in one company that does incredibly well. Everything else is basically pulling you down. That's clearly the correct answer if you're only focused on returns. I think as a manager, you care about volatility. And so even if you have a fair amount of certainty about one company, you may not want to only own one thing. And so by diversifying, you're reducing your volatility, but absolutely at a cost of the best returns. And I think even Founders Fund, you know, I mean, back in Founders Fund too, I mean, SpaceX was basically a $40 million position out of a $200 million fund, and it was a rocket company. Everyone thought we were crazy. But, you know, we made a big bet initially, and then we built that position over time as we got more and more confidence about the business and the market. And so I think, you know, it's not just about putting all your money in up front. It's about getting confidence with the management. Obviously, that was Elon, so that was easier than, say, other things. You know, getting confidence about the market. You know, it was a market where no one else was innovating, right? And then watching progress over time, put more money to work. And so I think that's absolutely correct. But, you know, from a returns perspective, but you do have to somewhat care about volatility because no matter how good you are, there are things that can hurt companies or ultimately push them, you know, to go bankrupt. So, you know, there's some value in diversification.
Well, that was going to be my question. It's like some value in diversification, but you know, the 40 to 50 company portfolio is often hailed as like the right amount for early stage venture. I don't actually agree with that. And I've kind of, you know, run the numbers with a Monte Carlo attached to it. And you're like, actually, you know, like 23 gets 84% of the benefits of diversification, I think it is. And, you know, you only get an incremental 7 or whatever it is for 40 companies. So my question to you is like, how do you think about the benefits of diversification and maybe where they tail off in your mind?
Yeah, so my version of that is I always tell people that there's a ton of value in going from one company to two companies and not a lot of value from going 99 to 100, which I think is very intuitive for people to understand. You're 100% right. I mean, we run our portfolio to be sort of a dozen core positions for this exact reason, right? You don't want to dilute all of your good returns with a bunch of other noise. And so if you could concentrate amongst a small number of companies, and, you know, we've sort of done some math and, you know, the heuristic for us is, you know, approximately a dozen, right? It could be 11. I don't think that's going to kill anything. And 13 is also totally fine, right? It's not a hard cutoff, but like something along those lines allows you to generate much better fund level returns while not taking crazy amounts of additional risk.
Yeah, no, listen, I totally agree with you there. I guess kind of the subsequent question for me is like, you mentioned kind of putting more into SpaceX as time goes on and building the position. With the proliferation of capital that we have today, I think, you know, we're more and more in a world where ownership on first check is so important. And actually in your winners, you don't have the chance to concentrate capital most often. How do you think do you think it is possible to build ownership in the winners? And how do you think about that statement?
I do think it is. I mean, we're relatively large investors in Wish, and we've been able to grow that position over time. In fact, we've been able to do that with a lot of the companies, you know, that we've been invested in. I really think your ability to grow your position over time is heavily driven by relationships. And so if you have very strong relationships with the company, you can maintain and grow ownership over time. And if you don't, you can't.
Yeah, no, listen, I totally agree in terms of relationship being central. Yeah. I think there's also just the question of like, how do you determine between like effectiveness of capital and like the opportunity cost of capital? And what I mean by that is when you have a company that suddenly is priced so high, you can follow on and you could, you know, continue to concentrate, or you could put another two lines in the portfolio. How do you debate that decision between opportunity cost and then concentration?
So I think this goes back to the question about cost of capital, right? So if you still believe that you can hit your cost of capital at those higher numbers, then you absolutely want to be writing those checks. If you don't think that you can hit your cost of capital at those higher higher numbers, then you probably want to be adding new portfolio companies to the mix. And that way, you know, those companies can meet your cost of capital.
Yeah, no, I get you totally in terms of that cost of capital thinking. In terms of like the actual multiples themselves, you know, we're seeing multiples that are pretty unprecedented, you know, revenue multiples, sometimes exceeding like 40x. How do you think about, and I guess hold a differentiated viewpoint towards revenue multiple for tech-enabled businesses?
Right, so 40x is kind of tough for a lot of things. You got to be growing really fast to make that work. And, you know, more importantly, it's not about how fast you're growing today. It's about how fast you're growing tomorrow. And so people have to be quite confident that you're going to be able to maintain that growth rate. I think there's a really important thing going back to heuristics when we're talking about revenue multiples. There used to be, I think this is somewhat broken down, but this sort of like quasi-magical, like companies got valued at 10x, you know, revenue, right? That was just sort of a thing. And that all came from, you know, ultimately like discounted cash flow, right? And so there has to be some discounted cash flow model, right? It may take a long time to ever get to that point. We may all be dead in the long run, but nonetheless, that's sort of how the math ultimately breaks out. And I think, you know, talking about revenue multiples, it really matters to understand the margin profiles of various businesses. And so, you know, when these sort of, you know, rough cut heuristic revenue multiples were done, a lot of the companies that were being invested in were very, very high margin, you know, consumer software or enterprise software businesses, like 80 plus, even 90 plus percent gross margin businesses. So when they got to scale, they would throw off crazy amounts of cash. And then I think, you know, people took those revenue multiples and they applied them to other businesses, you know, that were more, you know, tech enabled as opposed to fully tech software. And it's not that those businesses are, you know, necessarily worse in some sense, but you can't put the same revenue multiple on a 90% gross margin business with super high operating leverage as you would, you know, a company with 40% gross margins and less operating leverage. Like if you do that, you'll just never make any money. And eventually the market will figure that out. Now, eventually could be a very long time once again, but it just doesn't make sense for those two kinds of firms to have the same kind of multiple, right? And so, you know, all the valuation stuff, like the details end up mattering. And, you know, in general, you know, the kinds of numbers that we're seeing right now, I think are very hard to sustain over long periods of time, right? Could they be true for the next year? Sure. Are they going to be true in 20 years that everything's going to trade this high? That seems relatively unlikely.
I agree in terms of it seeming unlikely. And the multiples are so high that I'm just seeing an unprecedented level of secondaries on the founders' behalf, where it really concerns me at the size and stage, actually, bluntly. But I want to talk about this in kind of liquidity. Why do you believe that liquidity aligns incentives, especially when you look at the different counterparts of founder, VC, board member? Why does it align incentives, Justin?
So, I mean, I'll go back to, you know, something that we spoke about earlier, which is that it's the last double that matters, right? And when you think about what drives fund level returns, you want companies to, you know, keep going and keep growing before they exit, because that's ultimately what matters, you know, to the VC investors. And so you get this actually relatively big disconnect between the entrepreneurs and their investor base, because their investors have a portfolio of things and they're willing to take some risk of failure to try to get that last double. Whereas the entrepreneur has all of their, you know, net worth locked up in one thing. And if it goes to zero, they end up with zero, right? And if it works, you know, they might make, you know, 2x a crazy amount of money, but it's still, you know, if your base case is a crazy amount of money and then you can 2x it, like, do you necessarily really need that marginal dollar, right? These are life-changing sums for people. And so, you know, the reason why I think liquidity helps align incentives is that people can take out, you know, they can take out money that they can then use to pay off student loans or pay for their kids' college education or buy a house, you know, all of these sort of life events that matter a lot to people. And they will then, and I've watched entrepreneurs do this consistently, turn down acquisition offers that would put huge amounts of money in their bank account. And that's really ultimately to the benefit of the venture investors, because they really want to see that last double. They don't want to see companies get taken out at, you know, even $500 million or $1 billion, which are in many respects big numbers. But if you can go from $1 billion to $5 billion on a company, that really changes the return profile of your initial investment. Liquidity can help align incentive a lot when you're looking at the big outcome.
So listen, I totally agree with you there. I think where I get stuck, as I kind of mentioned, was like the size and also the stage that they're being taken at now. And so I guess my question to you subsequently is like, when's the right time? And how do you think about sizing when thinking about liquidity events?
So we built a whole fund. I mean, we've got institutional investors. Like, we built a whole fund around this concept of providing people liquidity at these, you know, growth stage, you know, venture-backed businesses. And that means that we're not showing up to provide people liquidity, you know, on day one or day two, right? We're looking for companies that have already built a product, that have demonstrated product market fit, and that are scaling quite rapidly, right? And so I think at that point in a company's life cycle, they've built something real, right? They've demonstrated that they were right about the product and can write about the market. And there's still somewhat uncertainty about how big this can get and how quickly they can continue to grow, but they've truly built a real business. And I think that's a good moment in time for people to think about how they could, you know, de-risk their lives and perhaps run their life in a way that's less distracting. Because I think the last thing you want is your founders, and deals with people specifically in this circumstance, literally concerned about how they were going to make the payments on their student loan, because they don't have super high salaries. They've got a ton of money in equity and they're having to pay their student loans every month. And I think that's not a good use of their mental bandwidth. And so not only does that align people for bigger exits, it also just gets rid of, you know, the stress that comes from, you know, some of the everyday concerns that people have. So I think that's sort of the answer to your question, like, what's the stage that makes sense? I worry about people getting so much liquidity that they sort of never have to work again. And that number can obviously somewhat change depending upon who you are and your family and where you live and a bunch of other factors. But there's always something that changes when people sort of hit a number where they truly never have to worry about money ever again. And it's a relatively speaking big number, right? I mean, it's not like, you know, a couple of bucks will get you there. But, you know, once you hit that number, I don't believe that people even know how they will believe, like how they will behave. And that's kind of the upper limit. But broadly speaking, the deals that we're doing with people, like, we're never getting anywhere close to that number.
Totally. Yeah. Well, actually, that's interesting. So you're never getting anywhere near close to that number. I would say that, and sorry, we're going deep on this, but I'm interested by it. Like, I'd say that number, 15 to 20 million, is a life-changing sum where if you manage it efficiently, it can absolutely last you a lifetime and look after a family very easily. When you look at your fund sizes, how are you not getting close to that number?
So you got to remember, when we think about, you know, like if I say, oh, you know, we're investors in SpaceX or Wish or whatever, Gusto, like, it doesn't, we're oftentimes doing business with many different people, right? So even if I were to make a $30 million investment in a company, that might be spread across, you know, half a dozen people over multiple periods of time or something like that. And so, you know, when you look at any individual person, you know, you're not seeing numbers. And you mentioned 20 million, and I think 20 million is a ton of money, but 20 million is very different if you live in, you know, Dallas, Texas, or San Francisco, or Miami, or Chicago, right? I mean, like, these things, and those are all major cities, let alone if you live somewhere else, right? So, you know, the amount of money is always somewhat relative.
Totally with you on the relativity of the money there. You mentioned kind of spread across a few people. I want to discuss another thing that you said that was really interesting, was that companies need to rewrite their social contract with their employees. Like, talk to me about this. How do you think about that with regards to kind of liquidity, stock options, and how you think about it?
So I've said this, you know, for a number of years, very much in the context of, you know, employees, when they leave companies, oftentimes have a short window of time. Sort of the industry standard is 90 days to exercise their options or lose them. The problem with this is, I think we've, you know, historically had a social contract where it was, you know, employees would join companies, they would get equity, and then if the company did well, that equity would be valuable and then everyone would make a lot of money. And that was just sort of what people understood. And what changed was that, you know, companies used to go public in like 2 or 3 years, right? I mean, that like, if you go back to the 90s, right? I mean, companies did not stay private for anything close to what's happening today. And so companies kind of changed the rules on everyone by deciding to stay private for much longer periods of time. And that's totally okay, right? It just had this unintended consequence of that, you know, companies, I mean, take a look at Palantir, right? Palantir basically, you know, has been, or right, they're now public, but they were private for 17, 18 years. And, you know, people might have spent 4, 5, 6 years of their career at Palantir, but that didn't get them anywhere close to the IPO. And so you want to be able to allow people to retain the equity once they leave. And what would happen after 90 days is they would get hit with these massive tax bills, potentially millions of dollars in taxes. They wouldn't have the ability to pay. And I think that really puts people in a tough situation where they either come up with millions of dollars they obviously don't have, or walk away from equity that's also worth even more money. I think if that continues to happen across the industry, we're going to break the social contract between, you know, companies and employees and end up with a situation where, you know, every engineer is hiring a lawyer to negotiate their employment agreement before they join a company, which is going to end up in a terrible mess.
Total terrible mess there. But like, what can actually be done? Is that not like restructuring the tax system in terms of how people are taxed on their equity? How do you think about the solution to this?
That would certainly help as well. But there are a lot of easy things, right? So, and this is a very much US specific answer, but you can have options that exist for 10 years, irrespective of whether or not someone is at the company or not at the company. We could just extend the option exercise period for people, you know, to that full 10-year window. May not be quite enough for all of the private companies, but at least gets people a lot farther along the way. And so like there's been a trend in the, you know, in the industry to start extending that when people leave to a longer period of time. And I think that's good. I just think right now, you know, it's the exception rather than the rule, right? We're still below 50% of companies that are doing that. And we need to get that number to like 99%.
You mentioned Palantir there in the 17-year journey. And, you know, obviously we've seen the extended windows of privatization with kind of the proliferation of later stage capital. My question to you is also like with the rise of SPACs, how do you think that changes the landscape and the liquidity game?
I think SPACs are interesting. In some sense, you know, all that is old becomes new again. And, you know, these cycles sort of repeat. SPACs in some sense aren't new, right? There's just a lot more of them right now. I think that there's a real overhang that's being created by the sheer volume of SPACs that people are launching. There are many, many good private companies. I'm not sure that there's 1,000, and we're very much on track for there to be like 1,000 SPACs in the not too distant future. So I think that's going to create an incredible amount of competition amongst the SPACs to get deals done. And then the quality of those deals will inevitably trend downward, which will then make SPACs, you know, look bad, and they will then go away for a period of time, and then the cycle will repeat itself. So I think SPACs are interesting. You know, they don't solve all problems. I think they will cause, you know, more companies to go public. It will possibly allow, you know, a subset of companies to go public at much lower costs than if it was a traditional IPO or even potentially a direct listing. You know, it just becomes another tool in the toolbox of ways to get to be a public company.
You mentioned that, you know, in terms of like the, you know, deterioration or the reducing performance of SPACs with the proliferation of them. I had Chamath on the show, and he said that we'd see venture returns really correlate much more over time to PE return, much more compressed with the proliferation of capital. Would you agree with him? And are you as concerned as I am by the proliferation of capital and what it does in terms of multiple compression for this vintage of venture fund?
I think that's fundamentally sort of has to be true, right? The more dollars that are pushing into the ecosystem, you know, it's going to have to compress returns at the industry level. But the industry, broadly speaking, if you think about venture, has never been a good industry to invest in, right? If you could only get the average returns, it was kind of mediocre. And if you couldn't get average, it was really quite terrible. And so all of the returns are really focused in kind of the top quartile of the industry. And so while all of those statements may be true, I think the top quartile of the industry is highly likely to continue to perform very well. Now, everything is relative. So maybe, you know, public markets returns go down and private equity returns go down and venture returns also go down. But, you know, there's still sort of an order in which they get stacked right. So, you know, you could still see compression across everything. But I think on a relative basis, you know, the top quartile of venture will continue to perform or outperform, you know, the other asset classes.
Can I ask, when we look at the 137 portfolio and kind of the mechanics of how you invest today, it is different from, you know, alternative venture funds in terms of strategy, as we discussed. When you think back to the fundraising for the early funds, was it tough? How did you think about kind of LP education around it?
You know, raising a first-time fund is, I think, always hard. I mean, that was sort of the experience, you know, at the beginning of Founders Fund. It was my experience. I talked to a lot of, you know, people who are starting or thinking about starting, you know, new funds. It's never easy to get kind of a new fund, let alone a new concept, off the ground, especially if you're talking to institutional investors who, broadly speaking, have buckets and they want to invest in things that sort of fit in the buckets, and they would prefer to invest in things that have been around for a long time because you have longer track records and there's more data. So that's always going to be, I think, a challenge to get these sorts of businesses off the ground. You know, in terms of, you know, how do you think about LP education? I mean, a lot of it was the arguments that I used to have with LPs, you know, 10 years ago were companies were going to stay private longer. And that whole argument, I just don't have anymore, right? So a lot of the education at the beginning was just getting people to understand that Facebook was not this weird anomaly, but was really the start of a trend of companies staying private for much longer periods of time. And that would make the opportunity to invest in, you know, really great high growth companies much bigger, and that you could access them in a way that, you know, didn't require you to lead every single primary round where there is a ton of competition amongst the primary investors.
Can I ask, do you not get competition from the existing investors? Existing investors wanting to, you know, grow their position over time, founders maybe not wanting to dilute, but having employees who do want to exercise their options. Do you not get competition from existing investors looking to grow positions?
Broadly speaking, no. I mean, most of the time, you know, folks are referring, you know, executives or founders to us. So, you know, very rarely are we in that position. Part of that's, you know, structural and regulatory. There's constraints on venture firms, you know, doing too much secondary investing because then they have to register as an investment advisor. And there's a bunch of regulatory overhead that comes from that that people are trying to avoid. There's some stage reasons. There's some structural reasons. You know, it just, at the end of the day, it's a somewhat different concept that, you know, people prefer to do the things that they're the most comfortable with.
Totally. I get you in terms of the comfort level there. Final question before the quick fire. It's like, you know, when you look back with the benefit of hindsight over the multiple funds now that you've raised with 137 and you see the plethora of first time fund managers out raising today, like fundamentally, like what advice do you often find yourself giving them from the experience and hindsight that you have?
A lot of it's pretty specific, but I guess I tell them two things. One, all you got to do is raise some money and now you're an investor. Whether or not you're a good investor, time will tell. But if you don't have any money, then you're just some person who really likes to take a lot of meetings, right? You need to have money to invest. So as long as you have some money, like you're now in the investor group. And then two, I just try to remind people that like venture as a venture business is an incredibly long-term business and that your LPs, you're effectively married to them, right? These funds are often 10, 12, 15 year funds. You know, you end up raising multiple funds. And so it's just very important to do business with people that you are willing to live with for potentially the next 10 to 20 years. Because if you raise a couple funds in a row, that's what's going to happen very quickly. And so I just try to remind people to try to take as long a term view as practical as you're building the business. So that way, you know, you can be successful over, you know, a multi-decade period. And it's just, you know, it's always very hard when you're starting things, right? You want to get to the next point. And sometimes you have to make trade-offs, but, you know, to the extent that you can, you know, optimize for doing, you know, taking a longer term perspective.
Listen, I totally agree with you in terms of that long-term perspective, given the time horizons of venture. I do want to move into a quick fire though, Justin. So I say a short statement and you give me your immediate thoughts. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
So tell me your favorite book and why.
I was always a fan of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I mean, how else would we know that the meaning of life is 42?
I love that. Tell me, what important truth do you believe that very few people agree with you on?
It's always a hard question, mostly because I don't necessarily ever know what other people believe. But I guess maybe one example of that is everything always takes longer than you expect. And even when you know that everything always takes longer than you expect and you attempt to account for that, it still takes longer than you expect. And that's like a very, very hard thing to internalize.
Tell me, what's been the single best returning investment and how did it come about?
I mean, honestly, I think part of that's just duration, right? SpaceX probably wins this for me. I mean, it will probably be the investment that defines my career. We've been invested since 2008, back before there'd ever been a successful rocket launch. And we've just continued to build that position over time. And, you know, we're one of the largest investors in the company. And I think it's a great example, kind of an earlier part in the conversation about, you know, people changing what market they're in, right? I mean, they originally started as, you know, low Earth orbit, you know, small sats and got into bigger sats and then people. And then, you know, they keep going from there. Now they're launching a whole internet constellation. You can kind of keep making the market bigger if you really have great people running the business.
What would you most like to change about the world of venture, Justin?
I wish that investors would just like stop destroying value. I think if you talk to entrepreneurs, they would sort of echo that statement. I think the number one thing that I try to do is just don't destroy value. If you can add value, that's really great, but just start with the basics of not destroying it.
What are the biggest misconceptions about the liquidity market?
So I think this is an interesting question, because in the venture space, when people think of investing, they generally think about, you know, a primary investing round where you're investing in the company. And yet they seem to forget that in the public markets, 99.99% of shares traded are all secondary transactions, right? And so I always think it's very weird that people think that if you do like a secondary or a liquidity transaction in the private markets, that's somehow weird. And yet that's how everything in the public markets works. And in fact, primary investments in the public markets are somewhat weird. I always find that odd.
Tell me, final one, what's the most recent publicly announced investment? And why did you say yes and get so excited?
So we're investors in Lattice. You know, one of the founders is Jack Altman, who I've known for many years. I guess, you know, it's just, he's a good guy. We've known him for a very long time. And he's building this great enterprise software company that's, you know, focused on, you know, HR. And I think there's a really an interesting amount of data that they can use to help people be more successful at the companies they're at and have companies help people be more successful at the companies that they're at. And I think that's really compelling.
Justin, as I said, I heard so many good things from David and from Apurva. So this has been so much fun. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolutely.
You know me, I just love a good chat on the mechanics of venture, and a huge thank you to Justin for being so open about their strategy. Also, if you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. However, before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carter. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carter can help. Check them out at carter.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that it is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20 VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you a phenomenal episode on Monday with Michael Eisenberg at LF.